All right. What's up, everybody? What's up, Dean? How are you?
I'm good. A little chilly here in Park City, Utah. And got my first little run down the slopes yesterday.
Nice.
Just testing out. Not a lot of snow yet, but it's getting
at some point, will they manufacture some snow?
No, that's all they've had.
That's all it is.
That's all that's been going on right now. But we're supposed to get like 10 to 20 inches here over the weekend. So
is it cold?
Yeah. It's in the 30s.
Oh, it is. Okay. Nice.
It's great.
That's amazing. Hey, so today we're going to talk about product market fit. I know the last episode, we kind of talked about the difference between, do I try to kind of understand the audience that I'm trying to reach first? Do I build a product first? And kind of led us to talking a bit about just kind of this idea of product market fit. So I just want to kind of run through just some different kind of thoughts and perspectives on this. I want to get your thoughts, obviously. Yep. And then we're going to look at a few companies as well, and just see if we can kind of, even in its most basic form, explain and kind of connect those dots for folks that are listening.
And this is probably top three things that you've got to work out if you're going to start and then have a successful business is, does the market want or need my product? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like first base, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got this great idea, but you know, if people don't want it and you're not, you know, fulfilling any need that's not being fulfilled right now in the marketplace, you're dead in the water.
Well, yeah, because the first step is always like, oh, this is a product I need. And then we kind of make the mistake of thinking a lot of other people really want or need this too. And maybe don't realize we're not part of the majority in that.
And I've had a million ideas of things that I want, but no one else wants.
Yes.
I wanted to do toothpaste in the shape of a bar of soap.
Oh.
And I wanted to scrape my toothbrush in the bar of toothpaste soap. And because I hated squeezing it out. I asked like 20 people if that was a good idea and they were after me.
So you never even tried it. You didn't build a bar of toothpaste soap. That's hilarious, man. That is, I think I could use that. I think I could get behind that.
I mean, you think about it, like the tube and the whole thing. Imagine just getting like the Dove soap out of the box and you just scrape your toothbrush on it and you start brushing. Mm-hmm. I thought it was
that's
genius.
Great. And I like to brush my teeth in the shower. So you could literally just leave it in the shower and that would be.
Yeah. I have multiple toothbrushes.
Same. So we're pulling from a newsletter that I really love. It's Lenny's newsletter, Lenny's newsletter.com. It's Lenny Rashitsky, which is he's done a lot of stuff. So that's really great. And then an article from A16's Future to kind of help us outline this. But both were really helpful just for me as I was like just kind of re-educating myself, reading through all this. But obviously Mark Andreessen has this famous quote, which is basically the only thing that matters is getting to product market fit. And then in a kind of a study on analysis of 101 failed startups, of the top 20 reasons most startups fail, 42% of them was because there was no market need. So almost half of these startups that failed. So obviously it's a big piece of whether or not something is going to succeed.
Right. Yeah. And look, the mind of an entrepreneur, I was thinking about this when we were going to do this today, you know, what are the dominoes that fall in an entrepreneur's mind? Right. So entrepreneurs like basically are futurists. Mm-hmm. And we're thinking in the future all the time. And then in the here and now, we're trying to see some kind of problem, solve some kind of problem, and then future play that out. And then, you know, this original product or service that I think is going to be needed in the marketplace, what problems is it going to solve going forward and forward and forward? So, you know, the early moments of ideas are in the moment where you're like, I've got this problem. And I think I could develop a product service. In my case, you know, kind of the major success that I've had was obviously, you know, mobile giving, right? And that was I knew the problem because I understood the business of, you know, that I was in, business of church. And I knew the obstacles around, you know, a couple easy things that are like so easy today, but back you know, 2012. Reoccurring giving and give anywhere, anytime, right? Those are the two problems I wanted to solve. And so I knew I needed it. The you know, the next thing was, wow, this, could other churches use this? And there was PayPal buttons on church websites. And but mobile first was not really a thing yet. So obviously, you know, the advantage you have in product market fit is, do you know the industry that you're trying to solve a problem? I think that gives you a massive head start. If you're trying to solve a problem in an industry that you're not an expert in, and I tell, you know, entrepreneurs this all the time, become an expert in something. So you know everything there is to know within that market, within that vertical, within that business. And that's how you'll know where the problems are, because you're an expert in the business, and then you can go and start solving problems, right? So I think it's much easier to know the product when you're an expert in the market that you're trying to sell in.
Well, and it's almost nowadays, you don't have to spend 30 years in an industry to be an expert. You can go online and YouTube and Facebook groups and Quora and Twitter. I mean, I have a friend of mine who's gotten into he's an entrepreneur, and he's gotten into like the RV space. So he bought one of those Sprinter vans, and he's been posting these videos on YouTube. And he literally just started joining these groups of RV owners and realized that they needed cutting boards for their RVs that were smaller than a normal cutting board. And literally he'd been in this community for 3 months, and just through reading these message boards and groups and Twitter and all the stuff. So him and a buddy designed these cutting boards, and they're selling like 500 of them a week. and it's just like, he never would have known, but he was just like, I'm going to find a product that these people need. And he didn't know any other RV owners except for online. You know, he just spent the time.
Like what you said then around education, this is the greatest time in history to learn everything about anything. Because everything's available for free. I'm not a big proponent of four-year college.
I tried it. I tried it a few times, and it just didn't work for me.
I did 2 years of college, and that was it. But, you know, we need doctors and lawyers to go to college. Yes. We need engineers to go to college. Yes. But if, you know, if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, go and learn Excel, become an expert in spreadsheets. Go and take Harvard Business School
courses,
lectures
for free.
Right. Go and do an MBA for free, on your own time, hustle it, you know, work 3 jobs.
I mean, you can literally find the 2-year reading list for Harvard MBA students and you can read the books. You can probably watch the lectures on YouTube. Right.
So yeah, there's no excuse now if you're an entrepreneur and you want to get knowledge about something, but it's great when your passion and your knowledge in a certain thing line up. Like, I don't really go for, you know, follow your passion and you'll be successful. I don't think that always works. I think it's helpful to really love what you're doing.
Right.
Because it just makes it easier to get up every day and go to work when it's tough. You know, it's easy to get up and go to work when everything's going great, but nothing goes great all the time. And so having a sense of heart and passion for what you're doing, I think is a, you know, not essential, but certainly helpful.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the things is, like, you got to be curious and you got to be thinking, you know. I mean, anyone that I know that's really business minded, they're thinking about it all the time. You know, my father-in-law is a business guy, and he'll be sitting in a restaurant, and he owned a chain of restaurants for 10 years, and he can order a meal, and you can tell he's thinking, and within 10 minutes he's telling you what this restaurant's making a night, what its expenses are, and it's just because he's, like, you know, curious. Love and that. I think that's the thing, right? Is, like, what can we learn? So to find product market fit, obviously we need to know if there's a market need, or at least kind of be able to think that there might be a market need, and then we need to come up with an idea to test that market need, right? But let's maybe try and define what exactly is product market fit. Now, a lot of this stuff that I've brought in terms of, you know, these are mostly VCs that operate kind of really at the highest level, and they're financing and funding massive companies. So what I want to do is just maybe read to you some of the things that they say product market fit is. And see, like, does that make sense for just the startup founder that's trying to become a $1 billion company, or just the solo entrepreneur trying to, you know, sell products online and build a business, right? So Mark Andreessen says, obviously, product market fit means being in a good market with a product that can satisfy the market. Another quote is, the term product market fit describes the moment when a startup finally finds a widespread set of customers that resonate with its product. So, yeah.
And that's a little bit more to do with like D2C, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Direct to consumer, which has exploded in the last kind of 5 years, really. Things like mattresses,
yep.
right? Mm-hmm. So like for 100 years, you went to the mattress store.
Right.
And you went and bought your Sealy or
you laid down.
Yeah, right. Did all that. But then how many mattress companies have started mm-hmm. up in the last yep. five? A couple of them went mm-hmm. public. And like, so the bet was, could I have a factory build better mattresses maybe? Mm-hmm. And could I sell them direct to consumer
right.
online?
Right.
And so when someone comes to you and says, hey, I want $10 million because I want to start a mattress yep. factory. And I want to sell them direct to consumer and cut out the middleman, like what's been going on for right. 100 years. There's probably, if you go to 20 VCs, you know, with that idea 5 or 10 years ago, 19 of them are going to go, you're an idiot. Right. There's no way we're mm-hmm. doing that. And then one of them is going to go, sure, here's your 10 million. Yep. We think that's a great idea. Yep. So very capital intensive. Yep. You're going to go build your factory, build your mattresses, mm-hmm. and then get a brand. And then start selling them and marketing yep. them in a way.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the mattress thing. I've noticed there's this company, 8Sleep. Have yep. you heard of them, right? So it was like they launched and they basically went like, do you want to be peak performance optimization? Yep. You're going to be smarter. You're going to sleep better. You're going to be yep. able to produce more, yep. which is their sort of yep. marketing thing. And then I think yep. Tempur-Pedic, I think, came out with like a competing product and they've got all the athletes yep. promoting that. Yep. So yep. instead of now just like a mattress that is comfortable yeah. that you can sleep on, it's now like, this is the mattress for the better athlete. You know, you want to.
Yeah, no.
This is the mattress for the entrepreneur. Yeah, right.
It measures my sleep and my sore points and yeah, the whole nine
yards.
But, you know, so and when you think about product market fit, really what you're trying to find is what's, and we use this word a lot, right, Tam? Mm-hmm. What's the total addressable market? Mm-hmm. What's the possibility mm-hmm. within selling mattresses online mm-hmm. direct to consumer? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, there's, you know, 330 million people in America and they all need a bed. And, you know, there's probably some data around people should change their mattress like every 6 mm-hmm. years. Or, mm-hmm. Like you go get all of that. And then you think, wow, average cost of a mattress is like $300. And, you know, then you're like, well, $300 times 330 million. Mm-hmm. And every 5 years they're swapping them mm-hmm. out. And all of a sudden you come up with, you know, I'm just picking a number. It's a $200 billion industry, right. the mattress right. industry. I'm getting that wrong,
yeah.
but
yeah.
right. But that's the process, mm-hmm. right? I've got an idea for a product. I got to get product market fit, but let me go and work out what my market is.
Right.
Because there's a finite market mm-hmm. for everything. Mm-hmm. Now, it grows, mm-hmm. you hope. Mm-hmm. Certain things grow, other things don't. But there's a market that you got to go and live in that market. Mm-hmm. That you know, I think of a market as like a country
mm-hmm.
or a city. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, the cities are right, markets, right?
Right.
And so, but think of a market, right? You know, so I sell church software. Mm-hmm. There's 350,000 churches in the U.S. Mm-hmm. There's about that many, you know, around mm-hmm. the world. I have a total addressable market of about 700,000 customers.
Right. Right.
$120 billion is given to churches every year in the mm-hmm. U.S. Probably double that-ish mm-hmm. for around the mm-hmm. world. So the most I could ever want to process through my app to is like 200 plus billion.
Right.
But then I got to slice off certain segments that are not gettable in my market. And then I got to look at competitors and what else is being used
right.
and how do I get people to switch and how do I get new customers? And so you come up with the market that you can sell to by working out what's the GDP, what's the gross domestic mm-hmm. product. And keeping with our example, what's the GDP of people buying mattresses in America?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you work out that, then you start to, then the economics of the whole thing start to
right.
flow through your brain, mm-hmm. right? So all of those things are happening as you're thinking about product market fit. Mm-hmm. It's the product, but it's product market.
Right.
And does it fit? So you got to think about the market as much as right. you have to think about.
And you're not just looking for, I mean, obviously you're looking for how big the market is, but maybe for some products you don't need as big of a market as you do for others, right? So just because it may be a more niche market doesn't mean it's not worth moving forward in, but that is kind of what I guess, really informs what the business needs to look like. How do I need to start this? Yeah. How much money do I need to, you know, to get invested to.
I mean, let's switch it up, right? Let's say I want to open a restaurant in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Okay. So product market, right? So what's my market? Well, there's 10,000 people within a 5 mile radius, mm-hmm. right? So there's my market. Mm-hmm. You know, 30% of those are kids. So those are not my market. I got, you know, 7,000 potential customers. Mm-hmm. Okay. What's the product?
Right.
I'm going to do pizza for, you know, $15 a pie. Okay. What's the competition selling it for? Blah, 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 mm-hmm. blah, blah. Like it works in the same in every right. scenario. Whether you're going to sell mattresses to 300 million mm-hmm. people or you're going to sell pizza to 7,000 people in a 5 mile radius mm-hmm. of your store, mm-hmm. it's the same thing that you have right. to do. Identify the market right. and then work out what maybe $15 pizza is, you know, too expensive in my market. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I could sell $22 pizza because I have a different demographic right. in my market. Right. But the same thing's going to work. And then what typically happens in the restaurant analogy is, oh, I ran this store successfully. I was netting a couple hundred grand a year from this mm-hmm. one. I'm going to go 10 miles down the street and do it yep. again. And because you perfected, that's, you know, product market fit is different in different industries. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to open a restaurant and perfect my pizza thing, I'm going to, you know, invest a couple of hundred grand in my pizza restaurant. That's my gamble. Mm-hmm. That's my mm-hmm. bet. That's my investment. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to test my product and see if it's good. If I've got aspirations to have 50 pizza stores, mm-hmm. I'm going to do one really, really well. Right. And I'm just going to replicate mm-hmm. it. In software, it's a bit different mm-hmm. because you have to build something with your own money, investment capital, mm-hmm. sweat equity, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to go and kind of release it into a market. Maybe you get, you know, 1.0 mm-hmm. with not too many bells and whistles, which is what mm-hmm. we did. Is the basic version.
And how many churches would you say you had, like, let's version one of the Tithely yep. product?
Pre-seed money. Yep. Probably 50.
Okay. And that was you going out and reaching out to those people and saying, this is this thing I'm starting.
Talking about
can you just try it and give me feedback?
Yeah. We had a website, mm-hmm. and, you know, but we weren't spending any money on marketing or anything. So it was just me getting friends to use mm-hmm. it. And sometimes, you know, with D2C, that's kind of super easy. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this great company called Allbirds. Mm-hmm. They're a sneaker company mm-hmm. in the last couple of years. And, you know, a product like that, you go get a shoemaker and you design a shoe and you say, here's the materials I want to do it. And you can get a prototype of kind of consumer goods pretty easy mm-hmm. now, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you just go get 100 of them and you give them to all your friends and you say, give me feedback. Right. You know, so there's lots of different ways that you're going to discover if the market wants your product. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if it's software or goods or services or food or whatever, you know, you just got to go and get small numbers first and get good feedback. And often you get all this great feedback. Oh, man, that shoe didn't feel right. I've got super wide feet and you need to probably do this for that. Mm-hmm. And that's a really critical moment mm-hmm. in developing the product, mm-hmm. getting customer feedback, mm-hmm. real customer feedback yep. from people who tell you the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big thing that they talk that, you know, we kind of pull out of these couple of articles, right? Is that one of the things you're looking for product market fit pre-product is, is there visible excitement? Is there strong customer feedback, even from a yep. very small group of people? So even if it's 5-10 people. Right.
Yeah.
Then you can define what exactly is it about it that not only do they love, but that solves the problem that they have.
Totally. And it doesn't always have to solve a problem. It can just be something they love. That people like. And it's an impulse buy. And I'm going to spend $70 on a pair of sneakers that look cool and are different. And there's a ton of different things that go into why people buy stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, having something that people can try, give you feedback is absolutely critical. And the investment goes from baking pizza in my own oven at home and then like taking that to parties and giving it to people mm-hmm. and them loving mm-hmm. it. You know, it doesn't, you don't have to open up, you can scale understanding how your product is going to fit in the market. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, venture capitalists exist to make really big investments, mm-hmm. you know. Seed rounds now, not unusual to be in, you know, maybe even up to 10 million if it's a kind of a tried and true entrepreneur that's had a few successes mm-hmm. and has this new thing and, oh yeah, here's 10 million, mm-hmm. go mm-hmm. at it, right? Because they've done two you know, billion-dollar companies before. But it's the same process every time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is my market? Mm-hmm. How does that product serve that market? Mm-hmm. And then you go and test it on any scale. Yeah.
And it almost seems like that's the thing that would separate a business from needing or having the ability to go get a venture investment and then yep. have to just do it a completely different way. Because a venture investor is going to want to know, yeah, what is the total addressable market? What does product mm-hmm. market fit knocking it out of the park look like? And if that's right. not big enough to, what would you say, 100x, 50x? I mean, what are is the traditional VC now looking at?
I mean, that's not attainable for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Let's bring it back into what most entrepreneurs mm-hmm. have to think through on that. I've always bootstrapped, mm-hmm. right? And what bootstrapping means is I spend my own sweat equity and money to develop something. And then when I sell it, I get a profit and I put that money back in. Mm-hmm. Usually don't take a wage for a long time. Yep. You're not pulling money mm-hmm. out. You're using the profit to grow the mm-hmm. business. Mm-hmm. That's called bootstrapping. Right. Now, at some point, you know, you get to 100 grand in revenue and you're working two other jobs to keep this thing going on the side. At some point, it's got to pay you something. And so you can take it to the next level. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you just bootstrap this thing for as long as you can. And what most investors would want to see is they want to see something in market. If you're a brand new entrepreneur, they want to see revenue, mm-hmm. right? It's very hard to invest in pre-revenue. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have something, and it's going to start with probably some kind of side hustle idea mm-hmm. that you're going to do on the side. Mm-hmm. You're going to work your 40 plus hours a week to feed your kids and mm-hmm. you know, run your world. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to, you know, bootstrap some idea and get to product market fit, get to some revenue and prove the thing before someone could come along and say, you know, here's 100K. I want 10% of your business. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's what's mm-hmm. going to happen
yeah.
next.
Yeah.
That's the usual step. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then in terms of some of that, well, okay. So once we get some customers, once we get some people that are using our product, so pre-product, there's some ways to test a few, you know, we're testing this on some people. We're working out some of the kinks, and then we kind of launch the product. Then it kind of transitions into like product market fit post product launch, right? So, you know, right. one of the big things right. that is said there is like, obviously the clear signal that you've reached it is like exponential organic growth, right? But also right. the idea of, are the users like sticking around? What does the retention look like? And is that something? So here, this guy, these guys who started the email app Superhuman, basically yep. they just, right. they, yeah, great. And I've used the product, and it's like, yep. all you have to do is go on Twitter and know that the people that use their product are the most vocal brand ambassadors, right? Of any, they've done a good job with that. But basically they say, you know, survey your users and ask them, how would you feel if you could no longer use the product? And measure the percent yep. who answer very disappointed. If that percentage is over 40%, you have product market fit. Yep. So they have, I mean, in their business, they have a very specific statistic yep. that they use or look at. And that's probably different for every single business and every single product. But the idea is that it's not just people that say, oh, I kind of like this, but it's like, oh, I would be bummed if I didn't have this tool, or I couldn't rebuy this pair of sneakers when this first pair of sneakers gets, you know, old and beaten up.
Right. Yeah. The thing about a market is it's both awesome and brutal at the same time. And so when you think about a market of, you know, people that are, instead of using free Gmail, would pay $20 a month, I think, you know, for Superhuman yep. email. Mm-hmm. When you think about, you know, like the market is going to determine the success or failure of your product. Mm-hmm. And the role of the entrepreneur, the founder, is to get the product in market, get massive amounts of feedback from customers mm-hmm. as quick as you can, mm-hmm. and fix things that they don't like, improve things that they do like, mm-hmm. and just let the market do what the market does.
Yep.
That's the beauty of free market capital.
Right.
When you take restraint, like, you know, government regulation, and when you let entrepreneurs do, mm-hmm. I was thinking about, you know, just the internet mm-hmm. and what the internet has done I arrived in 1996 mm-hmm. to the US mm-hmm. from Australia. Web 1.0 was just getting started, mm-hmm. like email, AOL, you know, all just the early plumbing, Cisco, all that early plumbing of the internet. And man, what that has done for the world.
Right.
In 25 years, so think back to the Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, late 18th. And then what that, then the assembly line, right? What that did, right? For cars and all the rest of it. And so the Industrial Revolution goes for like 100 years, transformed the world. Prior to that, the world had barely not changed in thousands of years.
Right.
It was essentially marauding, you know, kind of barbarians taking land and kingdoms and like there was iteration, you know, we discovered a few things, but the world had not done much for like 5,000 years. In the 1800s, things like, you know, electricity and current and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then the industrial, and then, and so that transformed the world in 100 years, brought a massive amounts of wealth. And then in 25 years, the exponential of what has happened just because of the internet. And there was contributors to the early internet, but it came out of the US mostly. And the power of that free market of ideas to discover and investment is just phenomenal. So, you know, you're an entrepreneur trying to get your product. You have to read the market. You have to kind of have a sense and a feel of what the market's saying about what you're trying to sell inside that market. And man, it's just a beautiful thing, because if you release things that the market doesn't like, you will be pushed.
Yeah.
And you know, there's most companies go out of business. They don't succeed. The vast majority.
Right.
Beyond just being little mom and pop kind of, you know, one man show businesses.
Right.
If you want to grow a business to do 10 million in revenue and, you know, have, you know, 50 employees, or you want to do 100 million, like that is rarefied. Every entrepreneur should think that they can do it and work every day and work hard to do it. But history tells us that
that's not what happens.
More failure than success, but that's the power of the market.
So, and like you said, what you said about it, the market is so brutal because it is, it's immediate feedback, right? How often would you say, cause I think about that and I think, okay, so you come to market with a product or an idea, which you can more easily iterate, right? But then there's pricing, right? So, like maybe for Tidely, for example, when you guys launched to where you are now, how many times have you either rethought pricing structure? Has there been times where you maybe rolled out a new pricing structure and everyone just was like not having it? And then when it comes to that, like how many times can the market feedback be not good and you still be able to come back for another go?
There's two thoughts there. Pricing is different. It's different for every kind of market, service, whatever. Software is interesting. SaaS, software as a service, which is really 10 years old. Famous kind of examples would be something like Salesforce, right? Basic CRM.
That would be B2B software that you're selling B2B into software, businesses.
Selling a seat at $10 a month, right? And as opposed to on-premises installation of an Oracle or an SAP, right? They kind of, when you think of SaaS, you got to go and read the story of Salesforce.
Right.
Right? That will teach you. And I was in San Francisco a bit ago, and right downtown, there are these two buildings, 50-story buildings, and they got Salesforce on the top of them, right? In 20 years, Salesforce is a multi-billion dollar company. They just bought Slack for what was a couple of billion or something. So if you don't understand SaaS, go and read up on SaaS. So there's lots of mechanisms and laws around pricing and SaaS. We went a different direction. We went free because we were more in the payments business than we were in the software business at first. We do a lot of software now, but you know, I had competitors charging for a giving platform, you know, 50 a month, 100 a month, 200 a month. And I decided to give it away and monetize the payment.
Right.
And I was competitive on the processing the transaction with all my competitors. So, you know, it was kind of the classic land and expand.
Yep.
It's like, I got you in for free. I gave you this beautiful little app that worked on your website, that worked on your phone. And then we either acquired or built tons of other software over the last, you know, 6 years.
And would you say that that early decision was probably, like, do you look back and think that was probably one of the most significant decisions we made?
No question. No question. I knew that I knew that giving, online giving, was going to be commoditized at some point, which means when something becomes a commodity, the pressure on price is being driven down. And I didn't think that there was going to be a time where you could get people to pay for something that someone else was going to offer for free. So I just went free straight away. And it took longer, but, you know, 37,000 churches later, you know, it proved to be the right decision. Right. And so, yeah, I just, you know, but, you know, let's think about sneakers, right? Like a great pair of Nikes is $100, you know, am I going to kind of develop this sneaker for the cool kids and, you know, would they pay $150 or do I want to come in at $75 and give them a really great shoe that's less than the market's doing and then get them as customers and then release a $95 version in a year, right? So there's the strategy around getting a customer. And what's it? There's always a cost to getting a customer, right? Your sales and marketing costs, whatever it's costing you to build the product or the service, that's your CAC, we call it, right? Customer acquisition cost. Good to know that. And then, because then you can adjust how much you spend to get that customer. And then you get into things like lifetime value. What's that customer? Once you've got enough customers, and, you know, I'm buying two pairs of sneakers every year and I'm spending $200, you know, and I'm going to do that for 4 years, you know, that's that customer's worth $1,000 to me. Right? Because they're going to buy two pairs of sneakers for the next five years. So, you know, all of those kind of factors go in on the front end. But yeah, it's pricing, you know, you got to pivot. Sometimes you come in and you thought you've read the market with your pricing structure and it doesn't fit. So sorry for that phone call. And so, yeah, it's just all of those things and you got to be ready to pivot really quick. If it's not.
Yeah. Let's talk about just a few companies briefly, maybe to just connect some dots. So, basically a couple examples of companies that found product market fit, how they did it. And both of these companies rather quickly, obviously you mentioned Slack, right? So Slack went the direction. So they grew from essentially 15,000 daily active users when they launched in February of 2014, to 1.1 million in June of 2015. To then 4 million in October of 2016, right? They didn't didn't have a multi-million dollar marketing budget. They didn't have a sales team. Essentially, they were winning the customer, right? So they had a tight feedback loop, able to accomplish a few things. And it's so funny because I even read this and any company that I've ever worked for that used Slack swears by it. And and then any company that I've worked for that doesn't has one or two people that work there that used to work for a company that used Slack, and all they talk about is how we need to get everybody on Slack as quickly as possible. And that's an experience across the board that I've had, right? Because they've basically focused on making it absolutely essential for the person who buys into it.
Intercompany communication, so it's not email, it's too cumbersome, right? I'm not going to use my phone to text my colleagues, but I can, it's open on my computer now. I got this app over here. There's probably 30 channels that I'm, we have more than that in our company, but I'm not in all of them. All my people are in here. So if I want to ask a question, I just got an email before I jumped on. Hey, I got a friend who needs a solution. Look him up. I'm like, absolutely. So I, you know, grab, I go on Slack and say, hey, Brandon, go and check out this. And so it's a fascinating company because what they did is they developed this product and people inside of mostly tech companies were buying it themselves or you know, getting the company credit card or just using it themselves. And it started in going invasive in the companies. And eventually they went to the IT department and said, we need to all be on Slack because 50 engineers are already using it.
Well, and then you have the problem, right, with some companies that probably have a really closed IT ecosystem and you start to have the IT guy hearing about these four or five people that are using Slack on the side. And it's like, wait a second, we've got to figure out a way to get this across the whole team. Right.
But it's the same thing, right? You build a product, you know, there's a market for inner office communication and my goodness, COVID just blew it up even more because now everyone's at home. I can't just poke around to the next office and ask something and say, hey, Michael, you know, what are we doing? It's like, no, the timing was unbelievable. And so they built this product and it got out in the marketplace and it was used like crazy. And to the stats there, millions of people using this thing, a pretty short amount of time. And all of a sudden, man, you know, everyone's paying $10 per or $5 per seat, and that's a lot of revenue.
And
of course, we love software because you build it once and you can go and sell it a million times.
Right. Know? Yeah.
And to support it and squish a few bugs and keep it going. Yep. And but then you're always innovating.
Right. Yeah. Let's look at Spotify next real quickly. So it's obviously a bit of a different. So that's more of a direct to consumer, if you want to call it that, but it's a consumer product, right? So the idea is for them, you know, Napster collapses, P2P file sharing. And that was for me, like I'm a kid in the 90s. So like, that's how I got my music. I downloaded LimeWire and then I burnt the CD, you know, and then all of a sudden all of those start shutting down. And basically what they realize is it's actually just the legal connection of how can I figure out a way to not get a copyright infringement and not be wholesale. And essentially they just said, what a percentage of people be willing to pay a small fee to consume this legally. And it exploded very quickly.
I mean, you think about it too, right? Apple, the leader globally around digital music. Right. And the distribution, right, through firstly the iPod and then the iPhone. When it was just the iPod, you know, and Steve Jobs had the phenomenal idea. He said, you know what? People will pay if you make it easy. It's 99 cents. We'll make it really simple. Here's a hardware device. And you know what? No one did Napster anymore. No one was burning stuff. And everyone just bought iPods because they were cool, unbelievable marketing, blah, blah, blah. And so one of the cool things I love about Spotify is it was a saturated market. Globally led by one of the greatest companies on earth, and they come along with an app that basically does the same thing as iTunes, and crush it. And what are they? 10 years old?
Yeah, 10 years old. Now they're doing the same in podcasting. I mean, they've kind of done the same thing. It's like, what's Apple doing that people don't love? Let's kind of go.
And what that teaches you is there's the if a market is underserved, there's always room for a new product or service. And, you know, that's the other power of markets.
Right.
The power of markets is you have to stay, you know, on top of providing for your customers what they want and need. And because if you don't, someone else is going to come and start giving them what you're not giving them. And all of a sudden, and they're going to come with new business models and they're going to come with new ideas and different features around the same kind of product. And all of a sudden, and that's the beauty of free market capitalism. You've got this competitive environment inside of these markets that just keep making products better. And who wins? The consumer.
Right. So let's talk about one that, well, I guess we could say failed, crashed and burned a bit. And that is the infamous Quibi. Now, obviously, we you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg is a legend. And, you know, obviously, there was a lot of talk around this company from the very beginning that it was announced.
And I remember the buzz.
I have a friend here in LA who had he's a screenwriter. He had a script that he wrote, you know, I think it was like 9 years ago, got on some awards list and kind of the script bounced around from studio to studio and Hulu made a pilot of it. And he kind of like, it kind of was literally dead. And then out of nowhere, he gets an email from this company called Quibi, who he had never heard of, and offered him more money than he had ever made in his life for this script that he wrote 10 years ago that nobody else wanted. And I think they bought the script and were in production in 90 days. And he was like, I don't even know who this company is, but let's do it. and so they sort of, there's so much buzz. And then they kind of launch, I guess the idea of Quibi was, will people watch these sort of bite-sized short form content, but sort of like one TV show, but 3 or 4 minute episodes, right? And I guess the model was they would even license content from other studios and just get the license for these short form cut up pieces. And they spent, gosh, what was it?
It was $100 million.
Let me see here. I'm going to see if there's this article on Verge about it. And I want to see if they give a number.
Well, you look at
$2 billion.
How fast? Okay. Yeah. Sorry for shooting.
No, you're good.
How fascinating is it that long form content, our long dramas, you know, longer, are crushing?
Yep.
You know, and I have a little bit of knowledge about this. My wife worked in television and in this business. And so you know, you've got hour long television shows, mm-hmm. you know, spending $10 million an episode mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. right, for the really good stuff. Mm-hmm. They go all the way back to a 1 minute TikTok video. Right.
Killing right? it.
Right. Killing mm-hmm. it and Snap mm-hmm. and everything, right? Reels on Insta. So you think, oh, there's this part of the market, mm-hmm. people consuming hour, 2 hour long, you yep. know, content. Yep. There's this other massive part of the market where mostly younger, you know, are consuming small form mm-hmm. of content in various different ways. There's got to be a market for 3 or 4 minute content. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Which is probably, I don't know how they yep. did it, but this is probably what they're yeah. thinking.
And these weren't not smart people. These were the most brilliant minds in the film and television industry getting their heads together saying, how do we create something? It wasn't, right. they weren't just like closing their eyes and guessing.
No, they're going, here's long form, mm-hmm. here's short form. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a market for something in the mm-hmm. middle. Well, guess what?
There wasn't at all.
And you couldn't say that it wasn't smart people doing right. it. And, you know, but the market didn't want it, or maybe they executed wrong and maybe someone's going to do it again.
Better. Yeah.
You know, in 2 years, but man, burning $2 billion to find out if a product was going to fit in a market, that's a brutal way. Yep. But you know, that's venture, yep. man. And that's capitalism. Right. There's winners and losers.
And you could also say that the track record of the people that started that company earned them the right to try it. Absolutely. You know what I mean? And it's like for someone that says they misspent $2 billion, well, it was their track record that got them the $2 billion in the first place, right? So it's
kind of as, you know, our final mm-hmm. thought here, you know what I love about business, and I love this about tech, failure isn't final. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, you can have a couple of bad ideas mm-hmm. and dust off and keep going. Mm-hmm. We could learn that in the church world
right.
a little mm-hmm. bit better. Mm-hmm. We see failure in, you know, people's personal yep. life or their marriage or like, you know, just whatever. Yep. And they're almost backbenched. Yep. For a mm-hmm. bit.
The rest of society loves to see a second comeback, and the yeah, church sure. tends to just do everything they can to stifle it, you know? Sometimes
we could be yep. better
yep.
at that.
Yep. So, yep. Awesome, yeah. Yeah, this is great. Well, thank you. Hey, listen, if you're listening and you're digging the conversation, share it around. Send it to some folks that you know that you think would yeah. like it. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Follow us on Twitter. And on Instagram, we're Kings and Priests Podcast, and we're excited about next year. We're going to have some great interviews. We're going to be talking about all kinds of different stuff. We're going to be talking to all kinds of business builders, founders, entrepreneurs. So hang around, and it's going to be a good next couple of months. We'll see you soon.